From the JAMA Network, this is JAMA Dermatology Author Interviews. Conversations with authors exploring the latest clinical research, reviews, and opinions featured in JAMA Dermatology.
Hello, and welcome to this author interview from the JAMA Network. This is Dr. Adai Adamson, the web editor for JAMA Dermatology. The incidence rate of melanoma has been increasing in many countries across the world. Early detection of melanoma has been associated with better survival and less morbidity for treatment and fewer health system costs. A previous single center study observed fewer excisions and healthcare costs, thinner melanomas, and better quality of life when surveillance of high-risk patients was conducted in a melanoma dermatology clinic with a structured surveillance protocol. This protocol involved 6 monthly full-body examinations aided by total body photography and sequential digital dermoscopy imaging. In a new study in JAMA Dermatology, authors aim to examine long-term sustainability and expansion of the program to multiple practices, including a primary skin cancer clinic setting. Dr. Ann Cust is professor of cancer epidemiology in the Faculty of Medicine and Health at the University of Sydney. She is also a faculty member of the Melanoma Institute Australia. She's the senior author of this new study and is here to discuss its work and its potential implications. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Cust.
Thanks very much. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm really excited that I get to talk to you. You've done amazing work in the area of melanoma. Some of our listeners may or may not be familiar with the kind of work that you do. Do you mind explaining what your role is at the University of Sydney? What kind of things you study? What do you spend most of your day doing? Is it research on melanoma?
Yes, it is. I'm primarily a researcher. I do a little bit of teaching, but I'm a research-focused academic. And I'm a cancer epidemiologist, but I mainly focus on melanoma and skin cancer, and particularly on prevention and early detection.
Makes sense that this type of study is something that you had an interest in. But why is it that you chose to study this particular problem, i.e., use the data that you got from the initial study looking at a surveillance program for patients that are high risk at melanoma and expand it? Why did you decide to conduct this?
Well, based on the first study that was published in JAMA Dermatology a few years ago now, it did cause a change in the Australian Melanoma Clinical Practice Guidelines in that for people at very high risk of melanoma, who are mostly people who've already had a melanoma and have additional risk factors, it was recommended then to use this structured surveillance program or a high-risk clinic program for melanoma surveillance among these high-risk people. So it did lead to a change in the clinical practice guidelines, but it didn't necessarily permeate through clinical practice, because the evidence itself was still relatively weak. It was based on a single site with follow-up over a few years. But what we really wanted to know was it something particular about that site that really made those outcomes not translatable to other centres? Would the same protocol translate to similar outcomes if we ran it in other centres? And the other thing that we were grappling with is that the use of total body photography, for example, is not covered by the public health system. And when we put a submission through to the body that regulates access to technology that would be subsidised by the government, they wanted to know more information about the strength of evidence that we had for the structured surveillance program and for the use of photography. And in particular, in terms of equity, they wanted to know whether the same type of structured surveillance program would produce similar outcomes if it was run in other types of clinics that were dermatology-led, but also in primary care-led clinics. And so we needed to further strengthen the evidence to really make a difference in terms of getting clinicians to use the technology and to follow this type of structured surveillance protocol, and also in future to make it more equitable for people to access this type of program in a publicly funded way.
Let me see if I can get this straight in terms of what the protocol is. So in these high-risk skin surveillance clinics, they have people there that often have a history, a personal history, or a strong family history of melanoma, and maybe they have a lot of dysplastic nevi. And the structured protocol involves full body skin examination every 6 months with the aid of a dermoscopy device, as well as a comparison to a baseline total body photography collection of photos for comparison. Is that a fair assessment of what this standard skin surveillance protocol involved?
Yes, and I think another key factor is the use of sequential digital dermoscopy imaging to really monitor lesions of concern. So if there was a lesion of immediate concern that they were quite concerned about or had perhaps nodular features, they would excise that immediately. But for other lesions where they were suspicious of but not of immediate concern, they would monitor the lesion, and the patient would come back often after 3 months or sometimes at the next 6 monthly visit, and they would look at the change on photography, and they would use that as a primary factor for determining whether to excise the lesion. And so what it led to is a lot fewer benign lesions being excised.
For your study, what was the major takeaway? Did you end up finding a lot more melanomas early in your study? Did patients and the clinicians that were involved in this find that using the standardized protocol was beneficial?
Yeah, so we followed 593 participants over a median of 2.9 years, and that was in four different melanoma clinics. So three of those clinics were dermatology-led, essentially. Some were in public hospitals, and one was a specialist centre at the Melanoma Institute Australia, which is a specialist referral centre and actually sees about a third of melanomas in the state of New South Wales. And then one clinic was a skin cancer clinic, which is a primary care physician-led clinic. But these are fairly common in Australia, and they're just focused on skin cancer, so they see a lot of melanomas. And what we found over that time, that we found there were 1,513 lesions excised, and of those, 171 were new primary melanomas. So that is a rate of about 9% per year per person. And people who had multiple primary melanomas were actually the most likely to develop another melanoma. The other risk factors for being in this clinic could have been having dysplastic nevus syndrome or a strong family history or a mutation in CDKN2A, which is a high-risk melanoma gene. But I think nearly everyone except for three patients had already also had a previous melanoma. And what we found was quite a high rate of new primary melanomas, and the overall benign to malignant excision ratio, including keratinocyte carcinomas, was 0.8. And the benign melanocytic to melanoma excision ratio was 2.4 benign melanocytic lesions excised for every one melanoma excised. So they're quite favorable, or very favorable excision rates.
Yeah, that is very favorable. And I have another question to ask you too, just related to how melanomas or pigmented lesions are treated. When you say excision, do you mean the initial biopsy is biopsied using an excision, or are you talking about a re-excision after, say, a shave biopsy is done, a melanoma?
It's referring to the final diagnosis of the lesion. So each lesion is essentially counted once.
Okay. So when you say excise, that's how the melanoma is diagnosed. Because often, yeah, in the United States, the way that we biopsy melanoma is through a shave biopsy. And then the treatment is the re-excision, right? So our terminology sometimes, I think, is different. So I just wanted for listeners that may be less familiar to note that difference at least.
Yeah. So in this paper, where the word excision is really referring to the biopsy and or the excision, but basically it's the removal of the lesion for the diagnosis, and each lesion is counted once in those numbers.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the benign to malignant ratio was pretty good. Did you anticipate having such a good result?
Well, we were hopeful that the same types of outcomes would be observed at multiple centers as they were observed in that initial study. And we were also hopeful that the same outcomes would be observed in the initial center. Because one other concern about the initial study was that perhaps they were missing some melanomas. And so over a longer period of time, that would be easier to pick up. So if they're removing fewer lesions, perhaps they're missing more. And we could show at that center that that was not the case when we followed up that same center over a longer period of time. So we were hopeful that was the case, but we didn't really know until we assessed that. And I think another key outcome then from this study is that it's not necessarily the clinical specialty that is the most important, but it does show that following, you know, a structured protocol and having access to the technology and being appropriately trained in its use does seem to be the key thing, because the people leading the skin cancer clinic were essentially primary care physicians that had a fair bit of experience in skin cancer management.
It is also notable that in your study, you found upwards of 68% of melanomas were in situ. And a lot of them weren't detected by the patients themselves, but by the clinicians. Do you think that this has some implications related to overdiagnosis of melanoma, which is an increasing problem that we're grappling with, particularly when we screen patients?
Yeah, there would certainly be some overdiagnosis here. And so that's referring to some melanomas that would be detected that if left undetected would have never caused any harm. And it has been estimated from Associate Professor Katie Bell's work that about half of in situ melanomas are probably overdiagnosed, and about 15% of invasive melanomas are probably overdiagnosed, at least from Australian data. It is a relevant issue. One of the issues with overdiagnosis is about the harms that come with a diagnosis. And obviously, having a melanoma diagnosed does set you up for more surveillance. It has mental health implications. I think for this study, though, these people, nearly everyone in this study had already had a melanoma, and they're quite high risk of having another one. So these people in the program were actually very reassured by the surveillance they were having, and they were having fewer benign excisions than they would in the community. From that initial pilot study, we did do a cost-effectiveness analysis where we compared the outcomes from the high-risk clinic to those from similar high-risk people being managed just in a community setting. They were having a lot more benign excisions in the community when they weren't under this surveillance protocol. So I think weighing up the benefits and harms of being in such a clinic for this group of high-risk people, I think the benefits would definitely outweigh any harms from overdiagnosis.
Yeah, and I think that's certainly an important point to make, that this kind of intense surveillance that was done in your study was for people at high risk, most likely to benefit. And so what would you say then to the idea that people say at, medium or average risk have total body photography and digital dermoscopy, sequential digital dermoscopy imaging. What would you say to those patients or the idea of expanding access to this kind of technology?
I think in Australia, where melanoma has the highest incidence in the world, Australia and New Zealand, so it's quite a common problem here, and more than two-thirds of Australians will have a skin cancer diagnosis in their lifetime. So a lot of Australians have things chopped out of their skin, and I think we definitely from this study show that the use of photography can reduce the number of benign lesions that are excised. So I do think there is a role for photography in reducing the number of benign lesions excised, which is also a huge contributor to healthcare costs. So I do think it does have a role outside of people at high risk. I think there is a role for risk stratified screening in Australia. And I think further work needs to be done to work out the balance of the risks and benefits for different risk levels in the community.
Finally, I wanted to bring it back to kind of the first comment that you made about getting enough evidence to convince public payers to cover this service. Do you think that this terrific study that you did may be able to convince folks that this indeed is worthwhile?
I think it will definitely help it get over the line, but they're also looking for some randomized controlled trial evidence. And we are trying to also fill that gap through a trial called the IMAGE trial, which is being led by Associate Professor Victoria Ma from Melbourne. And I'm collaborating on that study. And that is a randomized controlled trial of the use of photography to look at the same sorts of outcomes that we're looking at here. So I think through that trial and through this study, I think that will be enough evidence for the Medical Services Advisory Committee to make a decision about subsidy of this type of technology for the population and who it would be accessible to. And I think from an equity point of view, having it available to trained primary care physicians as well as dermatologists will be important, because there's not really enough dermatologists in Australia to see even everyone who's at high risk, because we're such a high-risk country to begin with. So I think with those two forms of evidence, that will be sufficient.
Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Cust, for this interesting discussion and the important work that you're doing in the melanoma space and trying to bring as much evidence to the fore so that patients can get access to high quality care. This is Dr. Ade Adamson, web editor for JAMA Dermatology. You can get more of our audio at jamanetworkaudio.com. And you can also subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts.